So as I mentioned yesterday, the idea for this retreat is to have a look at the word of the Buddha and to see what, how that fits in with the meditation practice and all of these kind of things. And of course the main purpose of this is not to go into great philosophical detail and theoretical issues, but actually to talk about things that are practical and relevant to the Buddhist practice. That's really the purpose of it. So it's going to be very practical, very pragmatic, and look at issues that are directly relevant to how each one of us needs to practice this particular path. And for myself, I always found that the most interesting part of the Buddhist teachings is actually found in the word of the Buddha itself. There's such vast, available literature these days on Buddhism, literature from the early period, literature from the later period, literature that is, contemporary Buddhist, contemporary teachings. And sometimes it's kind of nice to be able to whittle it down to the essentials, the thing that really matters, that really is the core part of the Buddhist teachings. Otherwise, it's easy to get confused, easy to kind of have too much, you don't know where to start, you don't know where to end. You don't know, you wonder what to do with yourself, it's just too much. So getting back to the core is often very, very useful. That core, of course, is the teaching of the Buddha himself. And of course, the reason why that is so core is because he is the one who started this entire tradition. Everything in Buddhism depends on the word of the Buddha. It is the foundation, the basis upon which everything rests. And if you take away the teaching of the Buddha, everything else also, in many ways, is kind of invalid because it is based on that. It is founded on those essential and core ideas. So this is why these teachings are so interesting, in my opinion. And of course, also as Buddhists or as spiritual seekers, there's one thing that we have to assume on the Buddhist path, and that is that the Buddha knew what he was talking about. If the Buddha didn't know what he was talking about, everything else is kind of, becomes kind of irrelevant. So that is the one thing that we have to assume about the Buddhism. The Buddha knew what he was talking about. And again, that makes his teachings very particularly interesting as a consequence. So what are these teachings? And it is not so difficult to find out if you look at modern scholarship and modern research into what is the earliest part of the teachings. It is basically these books you find here. This is basically the earliest part of the Buddhism. And if anything is the word of the Buddha, this is where you find it. So this is called the four Nikayas, or the four Agamas. They exist now in English translation, in German translation, even in Norwegian translation, right? That shows you how kind of fundamental they are. If it exists in Norwegian translation, that's pretty amazing, pretty astonishing. Yeah. Such a small little language. So these are the core things, and if you are interested in the word of the Buddha, that is where you're going to find it. But still, it's quite a lot, right? Still, it looks like a kind of a large corpus there. So the question is, how can we approach this in such a way as to be able to grasp the core of these teachings, not only the four Nikayas themselves, maybe even whittle it down to understand what these four Nikayas essentially are all about. What is kind of the essence of these teachings? And to understand this, one of the questions that is often very useful to ask is, what did the Buddha have to say about this? Does the Buddha lay down what the core Buddhist teachings are anywhere? Does he say, this is the real teaching, this is more kind of not as essential? And in fact, he does. And of course, that is then particularly interesting, because he then points the way to what we should study in more detail, what really matters as far as his teachings are concerned. And to be able to get to that, one of the suttas that is very interesting in this respect is the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. I'm going to have a look at a few passages from this sutta today. And the reason why this sutta is interesting is because this sutta is about the Buddha's last teaching before he passes away. And of course, in those last teachings, what he does, he lays down what is his real legacy. What is the essence of the things that the monks, the monastic community, and also the lay people should remember after he passes away. Yeah? This is part of what the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is about, because the Buddha knows he's going to pass away. He wants to ensure that the teachings are transmitted for posterity, for future generations as well. So to be able to do that, he lays down a number of things in the sutta which then helps the monastic community especially to look after these teachings and remember them and carry them on into the future. So this sutta is, for this reason, it is particularly interesting. It's not really a sutta in the ordinary sense of the word. The sutta is a discourse of the Buddha, right? If I use all the words that are really weird and you have no idea what I'm talking about, then please write a note later on and ask me questions about this. Sometimes I kind of assume that people have a lot of knowledge, but of course, that is not always the case. So a sutta is a discourse of the Buddha. And usually, a sutta is like one particular teaching given by the Buddha on a particular occasion. Yeah, one time the Buddha was staying in a certain place, and there were certain people listening to a certain teaching, and he would give a teaching to those people staying there. But the Mahapanibbana Sutta is actually quite different. It is more like almost like a history in a sense. It is the story of the Buddha's final days, and then interspersed within that story, you find teachings that were given by the Buddha during that last period. So this is that Mahapanibbana Sutta, but precisely because it is a bit different from the other suttas, it has some very interesting information, inspiring information on how to draw out especially the most important aspects of the Buddha's teachings. Let us have a look at this and see what goes on here. And then I'm going to just read very slowly, sentence by sentence, and then explain a little bit about what's going on here as we go along here. So this particular sutta is found in the Digha Nikaya, number 16. It's translated here as the Great Passing, translation by Maurice Walsh, who was an Englishman who was quite close to Amravati Monastery, actually, right on Sumedho, and all the monks there. And he made this translation, I think, at the urging of a monk called Ananda Maitreya, who was one of the very famous monks in Sri Lanka, who also passed away about 10, 15 years ago, something like that. This translation is very nice in the sense that it's very readable, but it's not so nice in the sense that it's not always 100% accurate to the Pali. So important to keep that in mind, because sometimes some translations are better than others, and all translations, it's important to understand, have their limitations. And the reason is because when you are a translator, you have to make certain choices. And by making certain choices, you are eliminating other choices that might also have been important. So translation is always good to discuss these things a little bit to get a broader understanding of what is going on. Anyway, I'll talk about those things as we go through this. So this is the Buddha talking. He's speaking to Venerable Ananda, and he has just told Venerable Ananda that he is going to pass away in 3 months' time. And Venerable Ananda is distraught. He is horrified. The Buddha is going to pass away here. What are we going to do? What's going to happen now? And you can imagine that the Buddha, right, is a tremendously powerful spiritual genius, the greatest spiritual genius that ever existed from a Buddhist point of view. He's about to pass away, the person that everyone always goes to find answers to questions, to resolve issues in the Sangha, resolve issues in the Buddhist community. You can imagine such a towering figure like that is about to pass away. It is ready, has a massive impact, right? You have at the end of the sutta, you have people crying and wailing and kind of being terrified. And too soon, the eye of the world is about to pass away or has just passed away or whatever. And of course, this is one of those nice epithets of the Buddha, the eye of the world, because the Buddha arises first. He sees things according to reality, right? And then he passes on that information. And of course, that is what makes the Buddha so important, right? He passes on his insight and makes it available to everyone else. And this is why he's called the eye of the world, the Loka Chakku. I think it is, right? I think so. This is, of course, that importance. So when the Buddha is about to pass away, especially after he has passed away, it creates this big vacuum, this vacuum in the Buddhist community of something such a pillar. The main pillar has kind of passed away and disappeared. And you can see here, even Venerable Ananda, who was supposed to be a stream enterer at this particular point, even he is kind of sad and kind of distraught about this, which in a sense is quite interesting, because usually a stream enterer, you would expect that they were quite stoic and quite able to deal with these things. But in this case, even as a stream enterer, you're having a problem here, obviously. Yeah. So, because Ananda is distraught, then the Buddha says to him, Ananda, have I not told you before? All those things that are dear and pleasant to us must suffer change, separation and alteration. So how could it be possible that whatever is born, become, compounded, and liable to decay, that it should not decay? That is impossible. Yeah, so this is the Buddha reminding Ananda of one of those basic, very foundational ideas in Buddhism, that everything that has arisen in the world, everything that has come into existence because of causes and conditions, it is all liable to disappear, liable to decay, it says here. And this particular teaching that you hear here is actually one of those, again, foundational things that is very useful to reflect upon. But the Buddha says, all those things that are dear and pleasant to us must suffer change, separation, alteration. This is one of those teachings that Buddha says everyone should reflect upon regularly, because it is one of those foundations of the Buddhist life, whether a lay person or a monastic. Is one of those things to always reflect upon. Because when we do that, what we do is that we're reducing some of our attachments to things in the world. If you remind yourself that things have to change, they have to become otherwise, they have to become separated from you eventually, it reminds you that attaching to these things is not such a good idea, right? If you attach to things that are going to change, that are going to disappear, you're basically asking for suffering. You're kind of putting up your hand, please, let me suffer. That's what you're doing here. Why? Because you're attaching to things that have to be taken away from you. And what are these things that will be taken away from you? And here, all it says all those things that are dear and pleasant to us. And when you start to think about that, it's pretty much all-encompassing here. It is very obvious that the material things that we are supposed to own in this life, that they have to change, is very obvious. At the very latest, when you die, all the things that you own are going to have to be given up. I think that's sort of kind of Buddhism 101. We understand that. But it goes much further than that. Then, of course, there's all our relationships, all our friends, right? Everyone we know in this world, our family members, the people who are closest and dearest to us. Of course, all that has to go. Our physical body has to go. The physical body, we sometimes spend so much time looking after the physical body, keeping it in shape, kind of building, making it look just right, all these kind of things. And one day, all that is left is a little pile of ashes after the crematorium, and that was kind of that physical body is done for. But it's actually even more than that. And what is more than that is so many of the things that we identify with in this world. Our sense of identity, who we see ourselves as, is related to this world. Things like our education, our social position, right, whatever that might be, the religion that we may adhere to or not adhere to for that matter, all the social relationships that we have, all the standings that we have, however we regard ourselves in this world, whatever our sense of identity is, even that is tied to this world. When we talk about when you die, of course, all of those things as well are things you're going to have to give up. So the things that are subject to change and alteration, the things that you're going to have to give up, especially ultimately when you pass away, is very, very vast. And very little actually remain when that point comes. And what is it that remains when you're about to pass away? And there's only one thing that really remains, and that is the mind that you have developed over a lifetime, and you have created whatever kindness and goodness and happiness that is in your heart, that is what you take with you into the future from a Buddhist point of view. Yeah, and this has incredible consequences. I'm going to look at this later on, even in more detail. This has tremendous consequences for our kind of investment strategy. Yeah. I'm not now talking about financial investments, but the investment strategy in how we use our life, how we spend our time, how we spend our limited resources. It has tremendous implications, because if you want to invest for the long term, you invest in those things that you're going to take with you into the future. You don't invest in those things that are going to end as soon as you pass away. Actually, it may end long before that, but at the very latest, when you pass away, these things are going to disappear. So it changes your whole horizon, how you deal with these things. And this is why the idea of, you know, rebirth and a continuation after you pass away is such a fundamental part of the Buddhist teachings. Because your idea, the way you look at life and the way you actually deal with things changes fundamentally as a consequence of that. That is one that this particular teaching is actually very useful in that sense. So it means that we attach a little bit less to the things of this world and we change our investment strategy. And you don't have to go to some kind of financial analyst to decide these things. You just go to the Buddha and he will tell you how to invest rightly. Quite handy, right? Of course, when we say that it's good not to attach so much, it's important also to understand what that actually means. Sometimes people say, oh, I'm a Buddhist, I mustn't attach so much because Buddhists aren't supposed to attach. But be careful with that, because whether you attach or not is not something that you can absolutely choose. You can't say, I'm not going to attach anymore. And the reason we can't say that is because attachment is an aspect of human psychology. As long as there is a sense of self, I'm going into fairly detailed or straight away here, I hope you don't mind this, because this is kind of fun. This is core Buddhist teachings. So the idea here is that as long as there is a sense of self, we are going to attach. That is part of, that is an aspect of the sense of self, that it attaches to things. And the reason for that is because the sense of self has an identity. And that identity is the characteristics of that sense of self is one part of that identity. So we have certain characteristics that we deem to be this particular self. And because of that, we attach at the very least to those things. And apart from that, the sense of self also implies the idea of ownership. You own those characteristics that is the self, but you also own things beyond that. So the sense of self implies attachment. You cannot have a sense of self without attaching it. So when I hear Buddhists saying, oh, I'm a Buddhist, I shouldn't attach. I think it's impossible. You have to attach. You have no choice about the matter here. So what this here tells us is that we should try to reduce the attachments a little bit if we possibly can. And the second thing, even more importantly, it tells us that we should practice the spiritual path, because the practice of the spiritual path eventually leads to a reduction and an elimination of the attachments. That's really what it tells us. Otherwise, we just end up suppressing things that actually are an inevitable part of life. So this is the message, I think, in this tiny little phrase at the beginning here. There's obviously much more to it as well. That is kind of the basic idea of what is going on here. So I hope I'm making some sense to you. Am I making sense? Yeah? Okay, great. If I'm not making any sense, please write down questions and we'll kind of try to make sense of it this evening when hopefully later on. So, of course, then the Buddha says, how could it be possible that all of these things that have been born, become, compounded, that is liable to decay, it says here, that it should not decay, such a thing is impossible. So what are these things that are born, become, compounded? Compounded here is sankhata, and the word behind all of this is the word sankhara. All sankharas are impermanent, right? Sambhisankhara, anicca, one of those foundational teachings, again, in Buddhism. So what are all these sankharas? I was just driving with one of you, you know, a couple of days ago, and we were discussing in the car, what is sankharas? And here it is right away. So what are these sankharas? And the word sankhara is a very broad word in the Pali language, used in many different ways. But the way it is used here, it is used in the sense of all things that have been created, all things that have come into being because of other conditions, and because of causes or whatever it is. So basically anything that has been created out of other causes, that is the meaning of sankhara. The word sankhara itself is derived from the prefix sang and the word karoti. Karoti means to make or to do or to create. And sang means like together, so like putting things together. Yeah, that is basically the idea here. So what is it in this world that is put together? What is it that is created? And basically everything pretty much has been put together. Pretty much everything has been created. When we say, when we use the word everything, what does that actually really refer to? And what it refers to is everything in our experience. Because from a Buddhist point of view, in the final analysis, it is experience that really matters. Experience is really what there is in the world. It is my relationship to the world, how I see the world, how I experience the world. Experience is what it really is about. So all of experience is compounded. Yeah? All of experience is what sankhata or sankhara refers back to in this particular context. So everything in experience is liable to decay. It says vaya dhamma. Vaya means actually liable to end, or subject to ending, is really the full meaning of that. So then, of course, there isn't much to hold on to, right? If everything is subject to that, to decay, everything is subject to passing away, everything is impermanent, everything will be taken away from you sooner or later, there's nothing really to hold on to in this world. There's nothing to grasp onto. It's kind of scary, because we need to grasp onto something. So what are we going to do? If there's nothing to hold on to, but we need to grasp, what are we going to do about that? And of course, the idea here again is the idea that we learn to attach a little bit in those places where we're kind of moving gradually away from attachment itself. And the things that we can attach to some extent are things like laws of nature, the laws that are always the same, and those things that are reliable in that sense, in the sense that they actually describe the way nature works, rather than nature itself. Nature itself is experience. All aspects of experience are unreliable. But those things that are the laws that talk about these things, they are on a different level, and for that reason they are reliable, something you can actually count on. And what is that? Well, in a nutshell, it is really the teachings of the Buddha, because the teachings of the Buddha are descriptions of nature. So things like the three characteristics, right, impermanence, suffering and non-self is part of that. Things like dependent origination is part of that. Things like the Four Noble Truths, these are what we talk about. When we talk about the framework of what nature is like, this is what we're talking about. So that is where you can have a little bit of holding on, because that is the actual, those things that can be relied upon to some extent. And of course, this is kind of the whole idea when we talk about the refuges, the Buddha Dhamma Sangha as a refuge. That is the place you can go, the place you can kind of find some release from the problems of existence, because they will be reliable to that extent. Okay. So, that is probably enough about that, otherwise we're going to be here a long time, so we'll move on to the next one. And then the Buddha says that, and that has been renounced, given up, rejected, abandoned, and forsaken. So the Buddha is saying that he has given up all of these things, and he has, of course, he has given them up precisely because they are unreliable. They are impermanent, they are subject to change. The idea in Buddhism of renouncing something or giving it up has more to do with the psychological approach to things. Yeah, you have given something up when you have given up the attachment and given up the craving. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to give it up physically. What it means is your mental attitude. So even the Buddha would still have certain things. He would have a bowl, he would have a robe, but his attachment had been overcome to all of these things. And then the Buddha has renounced the life principle. This is the Ayu Sankara. He's given up the force of life, if you like. Or you could even possibly translate it as the will to live. He's given up. He has actually given up. He's come. In other words, this is what it's about. When the Buddha says he's come to the end of his life, this is what it actually means. The Tathagata has said once and for all, the Tathagata's final passing will not long be delayed. 3 months from now, the Tathagata will take final Nibbana. That the Tathagata should withdraw such a declaration in order to live on is not possible. Now come, Ananda, we will go to the gabled hall in the great forest. Very good, Lord, replied Venerable Ananda. So here we have the Buddha declaring kind of once and for all about his final passing away. The Tathagata is a word that the Buddha used about himself. So that is actually the Buddha's a slightly mysterious term, but essentially it's just a reference to the Buddha. And this whole idea of the Buddha's passing away is actually in many ways quite interesting. I don't want to get too drawn on these side issues, but there are always so many side issues that you can come and talk about almost anything forever if you really want to. But we don't want to be here forever because we want to get out of samsara, so I'll spare you that. But the idea, of course, one of the problems in this, especially the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, is that there is a lot of contradictory information in there. On the one hand, you have the Buddha giving up the life faculty, right, and saying, I'm going to pass away 3 months from now. On the other hand, for those of you who know about this sutta, at the very end, the Buddha goes to Chundada Smith. Chundada Smith is this man who has a lot of faith in the Buddha, invites him to his last meal. Actually, he doesn't know it's the last meal, it's just a meal as far as he's concerned. The Buddha has this meal, and he gets really sick afterwards, right? And he has kind of dysentery and a very, very bad stomach upset and all of these kind of things. And then it looks like from that he dies from that. That's what it looks like in the sutta, So the question is, what is going on here? Did the Buddha die from dysentery because of diarrhea and loss of water and all these kind of things? Or did he die from giving up his life faculty? It seems like some kind of contradiction here, So what is going on? And the answer is, it's very difficult to find out what is going on here. Because there is this contradiction, and if you read the sutta, you can read the sutta in different traditions, and there's all kind of conflicting information. And maybe if you did a massive study out of it, and you wrote kind of, a two-volume book over 1,000 pages, maybe you can kind of get closer to the answer. But actually, it's quite a complicated situation. But as a general principle, the way I like to look at these things, when there is a conflict, I tend to like to go with the more naturalistic explanation found in the suttas. And the reason for that is because if you look at Buddhist history and the way Buddhism has changed over history, there's a tendency to elevate the Buddha into some kind of supernatural being over time. The further you go away from the time of the Buddha, you go into the commentaries, you go into Mahayana Buddhism and some of the Mahayana suttas, the more magnificent, the more marvelous, and the more amazing everything becomes. And the further you remove the Buddha from being just an ordinary person, just like the rest of us. But to me, one of the fundamental things that is so nice about the Buddha, when you read about him in the early suttas, is that essentially he comes across as a human being, just like the rest of us. And that has massive implications. It makes the suttas more relevant to us because the Buddha talks about his own life. When he talks about his own life, it is a teaching for us how we also should practice, right? This is how I practice. You should be doing the same kind of thing here. Now, if the Buddha is a god or he is a cosmic principle or he's something completely different, of course, all of these suttas become kind of irrelevant because what he did is not really relevant for us because we are different categories of beings, so to speak. So to understand the Buddha from naturalistic principles is, in my opinion, actually very important because it brings back to us this idea that the Buddha is a human being. He's just like us. And the teachings that he gives us when he explains his own history, his own practice, actually has direct relevance for us as well. And for that reason, when you see kind of contrasting things, like here in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, I prefer to take the more natural explanation, which is that the Buddha ate food that didn't agree with him, and then he passed away because of that. So that is my preference. Of course, it is also possible that this other thing is true, because we know how it's very common for people to have some degree of ability to extend their life and to live on longer. You know, we see these things all the time. Sometimes if you lose your will to life, you will die more quickly. If you are happy and well-adjusted person, you will live longer and all these kind of things. So, of course, there is some degree of flexibility there. But still, just as a matter of kind of principle, I prefer the naturalistic explanation of the Buddha. And this is something I will point out as we go through the suttas over the next few days. Okay, so that is the Buddha's passing away. And the Buddha says he will take final nirvana in 3 months' time. And then he says to Venerable Anna, let us go to the Gabled Hall. The Gabled Hall is the Kutagara Sala in the great wood of Mahavana. This is near Vesali. The Buddha is now walking. He started out in Rajagaha. For those of you who know your Indian geography. By the way, as many people have been to India before? Anyone been to India? Yeah? Okay. Great. Well, it's a few of you. Okay. So this is like, comes alive. If you've been to India, you know what we're talking about now. You've been to Rajagaha? Yeah? Okay. You've been to Rajagaha. Right. So, and this is kind of the nice thing about going to India. The suttas come alive in a completely different way. That's what I found. Because you recognize the places, you recognize some of the, you know, the geographical features in ancient India. And many things are actually exactly the way that you find them in the suttas. And that makes the suttas, to me, makes them come alive in a very different kind of way here, which is very, very fascinating. Anyway, so the Buddha is now walking from Rajagaha on his last trip, right? He's walking north. He crosses the river Ganges at a certain point, and to the north of the river Ganges, not too far away, is Vesali. And Vesali was one of the great cities of ancient India. In those days, great had a slightly different idea from what we have now. A great city in that time maybe had a few thousand, maybe a few tens of thousands of people in there. Yes, that is what we meant by a great city at that time. This is also very interesting, right? If you read the later idea of Buddhism, it talks about kind of the Buddha's time. It talks about how the Buddha grew up in Kapilavastu. Kapilavastu was, of course, where the Buddha was born and where he was raised and all these kind of things. Actually, he wasn't born there, but he was raised there. And in the later literature, it talks about Kapilavastu being this magnificent city, this enormous place with, you know, millions of people, it seems, and, you know, all of these kind of things. And then when you come back to the suttas, and you come back to the actual evidence that we have on the ground, like archaeological evidence and this kind of things, actually, things were much, much more simple at the time of the Buddha. And some of the archaeological evidence, like places like Kosambi was also one of the great cities at the time. You look at the structure of the city, it is fairly clear that it would have had maybe maximum a few tens of thousands of people. So everything was actually quite small scale at this particular time. But still, Vesali was one of the great cities and one of the places where the Buddha spent quite a lot of time when he was alive. So now they have arrived at Vesali and they have gone to this place called the Kutagara Sala in the Mahavana, the great forest. And then what happens next is the following. And the Lord went with Venerable Ananda to the Gabled Hall in the great forest. When he got there, he said, Ananda, go and gather together all the monks living in the vicinity of Vesali and get them to come to the assembly hall. Very good, Lord, said Ananda, and he did so. He then returned to the Lord, saluted him, stood to one side and said, Lord, the order of monks is gathered together. Now is the time for the Lord to do as he wishes. So here we have Ananda gathering all the monks living in the vicinity. The Pali word is Upanisaya, which means like independence on, right? They would live in dependence on a certain city because they would go in for alms food and these kind of things, and they would get the supplies. So they would live in dependence on their sali. And assemble them all. So the idea here, of course, is now the Buddha is going to explain something of significance, yeah? If he says, bring all the monks together, so I want to give them a teaching, obviously this is going to be important, yeah? So this is very exciting now. So an important teaching is coming up to kind of, you know, get ready for this powerful teaching here. And then the Ananda goes back to him. It says he saluted him. Saluted actually is abhivadeti, which means like really bow down to him. the salute is a very kind of ambiguous term in English, exactly what that means, but it really means like bowing down to it. It's a very kind of official way of saluting, if you like. Yeah. And then the anatta now is a time for the Lord to do as he wishes. In other words, please come at your convenience. That is what that kind of standard phrase really means. And now we come to this teaching that is so important that the Buddha actually gathers together all the monks. So, then the Lord entered the assembly hall and sat down on the prepared seat. Then he said to the monks, "Monks, those matters which I have discovered and proclaimed should be thoroughly learned by you, practiced, developed, and cultivated, so that this holy life, this brahmacharya, may endure for a long time, that it may be for the benefit and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of devas and humans. What are those matters?" Yeah, this is really exciting, isn't it? To me, this is the core. This is the thing that kind of drives Buddha forward. That is for the compassion, happiness for all beings. Yeah. So this is really the essence. So I'm sure you have no idea what's going to come next. Actually, you know already, so it's not that exciting. But it is still exciting in a certain way. Imagine sitting in that assembly. You haven't read the text yet. You have no idea what's going to come next. And you know, now comes the essence of the Buddhist teachings. Presumably you're very excited at this particular point. You're opening your ears, listening very carefully to take on board this core message that the Buddha is talking about. And of course, the first thing that is important here, before we even go on to that, is the idea that this core message is what the Buddha says he has discovered, right? So it's a matter of discovery. The Buddha doesn't teach out of speculation. He doesn't teach out of philosophizing. He doesn't teach out of anything except for his personal discovery. And of course, that is fundamental, because it means that and what we're dealing with here is not something that is kind of put together in a random or haphazard way, or put together after just thinking about it. It has a foundation in reality. And of course, that is really, really important. So what is interesting, of course, what is coming next here, so this is, of course, the practical things of how to practice the Buddhist path, how to move towards awakening. And one of the interesting things is, well, how is it possible to have insight into a path? It kind of makes sense that you have insight into reality. You might see things according to how things are. You may see impermanence. You might see non-self. It kind of makes sense because it is a looking at phenomena, understanding phenomena. But a path, what about a path? How can you have insight into a path that actually gets you there? And I think the answer is that when the Buddha reaches his awakening, when he reaches this profound insight into the nature of reality, part of that is also seeing all the causes and conditions that has led him to that point. Yeah, he looks back, he knows the kind of mind state that is required to make that kind of breakthrough, and he understands the causes and conditions that have led to that particular mind state. So understanding the path is not exactly the same as understanding, having the insight into the phenomena. It is more a kind of a secondary thing. You know the phenomena that you have to look into, and you see the kind of mind that is required to enable you to penetrate into those phenomena. Yeah, and of course, some of the qualities that are required is the freedom from defilements, yeah? To have a very strong mind that is not distorted by all these defilements of the mind. A strong mind that has built up in equanimity, in the ability to be steady, in the ability to penetrate things, because of that steadiness of the mind. Are some of the qualities that he has seen are required for this particular thing here. So in a sense, the path also is a discovery. And the Buddha says so much, as much in the Four Noble Truths, he has discovered the Eightfold Path. And then, of course, he has proclaimed it. And then it has this idea that you should thoroughly learn this. And then having thoroughly learned it, you should practice and develop and cultivate these matters that the Buddha has penetrated and discovered by himself. So the first thing in Buddhism is always about learning. It's about kind of reading the suttas and seeing what they're all about. And as you learn those suttas, you quite quickly find out whether you are really a Buddhist or not. Because some of the suttas can be quite challenging. can be quiet. There is no self. Okay, well, so what is there? Maybe there's nothing at all to hold on to in the world. It's quite challenging for people. And sometimes it's just too much. And sometimes people discover, actually, I'm not really a Buddhist at all. And that's fine. If that's what you discover, no problem there. Because we have to be honest to our own experience, honest to what we can believe in this world. And the only way you can do that is to honestly look at these teachings and see if they make any sense to you. So first of all, you need to learn this. And then as you learn this, either you gain confidence or faith, or if you don't gain confidence and faith, then maybe you have to reject them. Yeah, and that's fine. That's just life. This is just the way things are. Yeah. And of course, once you have learned them, you have to investigate them. You have to try to understand how they think about these things, to reflect on them. And as you reflect on these things, the solidity of your confidence and faith kind of increases. And it becomes also a matter of wisdom as you do this gradually. And then you have to practice these things. Yeah, you have to cultivate these things. And why is that so important? It's important for many reasons, but in this particular context, it is very important because the message of the Buddha can really only be carried forward by those people who have practiced these teachings and penetrated the teachings in the same way as the Buddha has. One thing is to know the teachings by heart and to learn them. Another thing is to fully see them and understand them through your own insight, and only then do they become real. There's always some degree of interpretation in the suttas, yeah? So how are we going to interpret them rightly? And the only way you can interpret them rightly at all times is through having that insight and understanding yourself. So to carry on these teachings into the future, it is essential that people still practice these things, that people have the same insight as the Buddha had. And when we have that, that is when they will be carried on into the future and they will be safeguarded. So we have to hope, right, that there still are some areas in the world, there still are some noble ones. Because if there aren't any noble ones, then the thing will kind of decline very, very, very quickly. That's another very exciting question. Are there any noble ones in the world? Are there any arahants left? If so, where are they? Yeah, it's one of those kind of almost unfathomable questions. We should probably talk about that, because actually it's very interesting here. A very interesting thing here. How do we decide whether somebody is not is an Arya? How do we decide whether somebody is an Arahant? Do they still exist in the world? If they do exist, are they in decline or are they kind of increasing in number? What is going on there? And usually things are decreasing, right? This is one of the problems in the world. So usually things are going downhill. It seems to be one of those, it is pretty much a law. It actually started at the time of the Buddha already. Somebody asked the Buddha, why is it that there are fewer arahants, but more rules, more discipline? This was one of the questions asked at the time of the Buddha. So it started 2,500 years ago, and it probably didn't end very... It probably has been going on ever since. So it's the importance of cultivating and practicing. Of course, to have the results of no suffering, but also to enable the teachings to move forward into the future. So, and then the idea that it may be for the benefit and happiness of the multitude out of compassion for the world, yeah? For the benefit and happiness of devas, like the gods and humans. And this is the essence of the Buddhist teachings. And this is what makes the Buddhist teachings so powerful and so beautiful, that at the end of the day, they have only one purpose, and that is to end or reduce pain and suffering and trouble in life, and to increase the happiness, the contentment, the joy, the peace, the tranquility, the metta, the kindness, the compassion, all of these beautiful qualities, to improve in that, and to decrease in the bad ones. Yeah, this is the whole purpose of the Buddhist path. And ultimately, it is to reach the highest happiness, of course, which is Nibbana itself. And this, to me, is what makes the Buddhist teaching so extraordinarily powerful, that they go to the very essence of what is the most fundamental yearning of the human heart, not just humans, anyone really, any animal or whatever it is. It goes to the very foundation of what we are as beings. Our search for happiness in the world, our avoidance for suffering. It goes to the very heart of what we've always been looking for. Yeah, so to me, for that reason, the Buddha's teaching, when I came across them, I understood that this is the answer to the meaning of life. Yeah, it goes to the very thing that we're always yearning for, where we want to head, but we can't really find the path. We crave, and a craving, of course, is in itself a yearning for a sense of satisfaction. completion, contentment in the world. We follow the craving, and there is no result by doing that. It doesn't actually get you to where the craving promises that it will take you there. And because of that, when the Buddhist teaching comes around, it's a different teaching. It shows you the path of following your craving doesn't work. There is another way where you can actually find that satisfaction. We can find a sense of completion, the sense of fulfillment that you always thought would be found in craving. It is found in a different place. So to me, it is the answer to the question of the meaning of life. And once you get that feeling, you have to commit yourself, right? This is why I wear these funny clothes and I kind of shave my head. Because you have to commit yourself once you feel that this is the answer to basically what life is all about. This is kind of the essence here. It kind of comes out in the very kind of by the by statement, you know, it is for the happiness of everyone. But this actually is a very, when you look at it from an overall point of view of the Buddhist teachings, it's a very profound statement that really makes the whole Buddhist teaching so special in the first place. So, what are these matters? And that finally we come to what these things actually are. What are the things that we should learn, that we should practice, develop, and cultivate, and also realize for that matter? And they are the following. The four foundations of mindfulness. The four right efforts. The four roads to power. The five spiritual faculties. The five mental powers. The seven factors of enlightenment. And the Noble Eightfold Path. These are these things that should be remembered, practiced, and cultivated, and realized by everyone for the endurance of this holy life as long into the future as you possibly can. So what are these things? And I'm sure you recognize all of these things straight away. And what these things are, they are called the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas as a group. And this is often translated into English as the 37 aids to awakening. Yeah, so these are the things that support awakening on the Buddhist path, the things that eventually lead you to awakening. That's what these things are about. What they really amount to, if you look at these things and you kind of pull them apart and see what they are, what they really amount to, they amount to the Noble Eightfold Path. So these things are an expansion, if you like, of the Noble Eightfold Path. Put them all together, and that is what they are. Yeah, so the Noble Eightfold Path is a summary, if you like, of these 37 factors. And the Noble Eightfold Path, in turn, can be expanded into what is often called the gradual training. The gradual training is an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, so this is why, and now we kind of come to one of the important things. Yeah, this is why one of the core things I will be talking about during this retreat is the gradual training. And that is here, it is Majjhima Nikaya 27, the shortest sutta of the simile of the elephant's footprint. That is one version, many, many versions of the gradual training in the suttas. This is one of those, and this is what I will be focusing on, because it is really an expanded version, or it is a way of looking at these 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. So, I'm going to take the word of the Buddha for what it is, and I'm going to focus exactly on what the Buddha said we should focus on as far as his path is concerned. Yeah? So I hope you're happy with me for that, that I'm actually doing what the Buddha says, instead of kind of going my own way and saying kind of other stuff which may not be so relevant. So, what are these 37 things? Now, one of the interesting things, when you look at all of those 37 factors, one of the things that you see straight away is that they are all practical things. Yeah? They're pragmatic. It's about how to practice what we have to do to move forward on the path and perhaps one day reach awakening itself. So very practical things, these 37 things. This is kind of one of the foundational things. There's nothing really here which is philosophical or which is about a more of an intellectual nature. It's more about what we have to do to move forward on the Buddhist path. So this is the first thing to realize about this. The other thing which is, important here is to actually understand how all of these things are connected together, how they actually work together as a whole. And as I just said, this is really just an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path. So how is it that they are an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path? Let's have a quick look at that, just to kind of see how it all fits together here. So we have here the four foundations of mindfulness. These are the Satipatthanas. Yeah, so the first thing we can, of course, query here is whether that translation is a good one. And the way I would prefer to translate this is the four applications of mindfulness. In other words, how we apply mindfulness on the Buddhist path. This is my preferred translation. Why is that? And the reason is, when you translate it as the four foundations of mindfulness, it sounds as if these are the things that you do to give rise to mindfulness, right? They are the foundations upon which mindfulness arises, upon which it is practiced. But actually, when you read the things like the Satipatthana Sutta, and you read other parts of the Buddhist path, you see that actually it is more to do with how we use mindfulness once it has been established. So we establish mindfulness, as I was saying yesterday. This is kind of the foundation for any kind of meditation to be possible. And once that has been established, then Satipatthana actually kicks in, and you apply it in certain ways. So that's why I prefer the four applications of mindfulness as a translation there. And of course, the four applications of mindfulness is really just an expansion of the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is Samma Sati, right mindfulness. So it is an expansion of that factor. So it slots in straight away into the Noble Eightfold Path. Then you have the four right efforts, which I think is an okay translation. Of course, that is an expansion of the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right effort. Yeah, then you have here the four roads to power, it's called here. It sounds like if you want to become the president of some country or something, you should practice these things. And maybe you should, actually. Maybe if you want to become powerful, you should practice these things. But that's not what this is really about. That would be a sidetrack, so let's not go down that way. So what this really is about is called the Iddhipadas. And Iddhi in Pali is a word for, which we like, supernormal powers. Yeah, and the Pada here is really, if you like, a pathway. So these are the pathways to supernormal powers. So if you like some supernormal powers, anyone who likes some supernormal powers? That'd be cool. Yes, okay. We have someone nodding in the back. It would be quite cool to have some supernormal powers, right? So if you like some supernormal powers, this is the way to go. This is the path to supernormal powers. But what it is really about samadhi practice, different ways of attaining samadhi and unification of mind. So really, it is just an expansion of the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. That's really what it is. And one of the consequences of practicing samadhi, according to the Buddhist teaching, is supernormal powers. Yeah, I might talk a bit about supernormal powers later on, because it's quite cool. You know, according to the suttas, I have never seen this myself. As always, this is just straight according to the suttas. You can do all kind of crazy things like, you know, floating in the air, sinking into the earth, and going into the earth, walking through the walls, going through the mountain, this kind of stuff. So it's kind of entertaining, isn't it? But the problem is, it doesn't really go much beyond entertainment. That is kind of the problem with these things. But anyway, I'm getting way too sidetracked now, so let's get back to to what this is about. So that is an expansion of the samadhi aspect, Samma Samadhi on the Noble Eightfold Path. Then you have the five spiritual faculties, which is the Panch Indriya, and the five mental powers, which is the Panchabala. And these are the particular qualities of the mind that arise when you become an Arya, when you become a noble person. These qualities become established in the mind. And of course, these qualities are qualities that then, once they are established, they make ensure that you will always make progress on the Buddhist path. There's no kind of turning back anymore, because these things are solid inside of you, because you're an Arya. The five spiritual faculties, the five mental powers, are basically the same thing, just with slightly different names on them. Then we have the seven factors of enlightenment, which I prefer to call the seven factors of awakening. So these are the Sambhujangas. And this is, of course, the same word as the word Buddha, or Bodhi, although these words mean really awakening. And I prefer the word awakening to enlightenment, because to me it is more meaningful. And then last of all, and sorry, I didn't say how they fit into the path, The seven factors of awakening, they're all about the two last factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? So the first factor of enlightenment is the Sati Sambhojanga, and Sati Sambhojanga is equivalent to the, in many ways, to the Satipatthana themselves. Sati Sambhojanga, Sati, mindfulness, Sambhojanga, factor of awakening. So the factor of awakening, which is mindfulness. And that is very, that is basically the same as the Satipatthana practice. And then it goes all the way up. I don't have time to talk about them now. I should really have enough time for that. But this is how things usually go on these retreats. There's never enough time. But and then it goes all the way up to Samadhi and Upeka. Yeah, and Samadhi and Upeka, they are the highest aspects, if you like, of Samadhi itself, to do with the fourth jhana and all of these kind of things. So the Bhojangas are equivalent. It's an expansion, if you like, a pulling apart of the last two factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, so now you can see how it all fits together. And if you practice the Noble Eightfold Path, you are really practicing all the 37 factors of aids to awakening by doing that. That's all you have to do. And then again, you expand the Noble Eightfold Path, and you expand it into the gradual training. And we're going to look at that later on, how to practice that Noble Eightfold Path in great detail. That is the main aim of this retreat, is to look at that. One of the reasons why I like to look at the full Buddhist path rather than just focusing on meditation practice is because it's only in the context of the full path that meditation has any meaning. Meditation arises from the more fundamental parts of the path, and in turn it gives rise to other factors that are even more profound than meditation itself. So the whole context needs to be understood. And when you understand the whole context, you know where on the path you are, what you have to do, what is it essential to focus on, and then all the other things happen as a matter of course. Okay, so let's do the very last few lines just to finish off this particular passage. Okay, then the Lord said to the monks, "And now, monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on untiringly. The Tathagata's final passing away will not be long delayed. 3 months from now, the Tathagata will take his final Nibbana." So here he makes this declaration that his life is coming to an end. And of course, this very last thing here is one of the very famous statements by the Buddha. It's a statement that he also does as he's about to pass away at the very end. And here he also declares it prior to that. "I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Vaya Dhamma Sankara" is the Pali here. "Vaya Dhamma Sankara," right? Vaya means end, quite literally. And Sankara, again, is this word I was talking about before, which means all conditioned phenomena. In other words, all of our experience of the world has a nature to come to an end. Nothing can be held on to. Everything is unreliable. There's nowhere to attach. There's nowhere to crave for it. Why? Because it's always going to be taken away from us. And one of the nice ways I like to think about this, if you think about everything as being impermanent, everything as being unreliable, it's like standing on the carpet, and then somebody coming, grabbing the carpet in one end, and pulling you out under your feet. And if somebody does that, you lose your balance, right? You fall over, you topple over, and you hurt, and you break a leg, or you break an arm, or whatever it is, as a consequence of that. And that is exactly what samsara is like. There's nowhere to stand. There's nowhere to attach. There's nothing to hold on to. There's no safety. There's nothing that is reliable. So wherever you stand, whenever you attach to something, somebody's going to come, you're going to pull out the carpet from under your feet, and you're going to fall over, and you're going to hurt, and you're going to suffer as a consequence. This is what the Buddha is saying here, yeah? This is kind of the import, the kind of the essence of what this statement is about. There's so much meaning sometimes, the very simple statements in the suttas, so it's actually quite useful to unpack some of these things. Strive on untiringly. Appamadena sampadeta is the Pali behind that. Appamadena sampadeta. What does it mean? Does it mean strive on untiringly? Not really. Doesn't really mean that. Unfortunately, Maurice Walsh. So I don't really want to criticize translators too much, because it's actually very, very hard to translate it, and it's done a very good job in many ways. But this isn't quite accurate, just to be perfectly honest, because appamada in Pali is not about being untiring or kind of being diligent or anything like that. Appamada in Pali means to be heedful. Yeah, and the English word heedful means to be careful, it means to be circumspect, it means to think about carefully before you take an action, all of these kind of things. That is what it actually means. So it's more about kind of thinking about things carefully, observing things, doing things in the right way. That is really what it means. And sampadeta does not really mean to strive. The verb sampadeta actually means to succeed. So it means, how are we going to succeed? And what the Buddha is saying here is that you will succeed. In other words, succeed through heedfulness. That is actually what this means. This is a much more literal translation of the Pali here. Succeed monks through heedfulness. Succeed nuns through heedfulness. Succeed lay people, through heedfulness. Everyone, this is the way you will succeed on the Buddha's path. By being heedful, by being careful, by being circumspect. And then you will practice in the right way here. Quite different, right? Succeed through heedfulness and strive on untiringly. There's some similarity between those things, but the kind of feeling about it is quite different. One is about wisdom, about being careful, about being circumspect. The other one is about exerting yourself, using willpower, trying to get there. There's quite different feel to these two kinds of expressing what the Buddha is saying here. And then the Buddha says that, of course, reminding everyone that the Buddha's passing away will be soon. And that is why now is your chance. Don't waste the opportunity. This is the chance to practice these things. And of course, in many ways, that message is just as relevant today as it was 2,500 years ago. As I kind of hinted before, we see the Dhamma always, in a sense, declining, becoming more and more unreliable. You read the suttas, there's more and more corruption creeping into the suttas. Less and less noble ones, less and less areas in the world. We can see that maybe more easily as a monastic, because you know what is going on. But it's kind of feeling of a slow decline of things. This idea of succeed through heedfulness, strive on, because things are gradually decreased, gradually disappearing, is just as relevant today as it was then. But do it in the right way. Do it through wisdom rather than through willpower is actually part of the saying here. Okay, so that is, I've not bombarded you for 1 hour with with various things. I hope you isn't too much. I'm going to stop there and come back again, continue at 3 o'clock this afternoon. In the meantime, enjoy yourself, have a nice lunch, and then we'll see you again at 3 o'clock.